I left off with the political history last time, it was in A.D. 69 with the suicide of Nero. But even before Nero committed suicide, and the main cause for it, was the fact that the army in Spain had already rebelled against his reign and had elected their general, a man named Galba, to be emperor in place of Nero. And indeed, what happened with the death of Nero was that various armies began nominating their own leaders to be the next emperor. Nero was the last of the Julio-Claudian line. Galba was successful in establishing himself in Rome, but he was 70 years old and, like a good many generals, lacking in tact. And the result was that he rapidly offended the people in Rome, offended the entire senatorial class, and also offended the man who expected to be his successor to the throne. The result was he was killed off. And the man who expected to be successor, named Otto, was put in as emperor. But in the meantime, the armies of the Rhine were marching on Rome, proclaiming their emperor named Vitellius, their general Vitellius, as the new emperor. And Otto was defeated, and Vitellius took over Rome in his turn. Vitellius was a man interested almost solely in food. He spent his entire 6 months as emperor doing nothing but eating enormous amounts of food. And in the meantime, over in the east, the armies in Judea and the Danube had not yet risen. Now, the situation in Judea was that there had been a Jewish revolt against the Romans. It had been started because a Roman governor of Judea had seized part of the temple treasure. And this had started a major Jewish revolt headed by the Pharisees, who soon became known as the Zealots. Indeed, the general Vespasian was laying siege at this time to the city of Jerusalem itself, which was held by the Zealots. The rest of the revolt had already been put down. But now the Danube and the eastern armies proclaimed him emperor, and he marched off against Vitellius in Rome, leaving his older son Titus to carry on the siege against Jerusalem. Now, Vespasian managed to arrive at Rome, where there was a disorganized army of Vitellius camped around the city, and Vitellius tried to abdicate. His soldiers wouldn't have it, and the result was that the war was fought up and down the streets of Rome between the two armies. As far as we can tell, the Roman citizens loved it. The best damn gladiatorial show they'd seen in many a long year. They seemed to have stood at windows and on rooftops cheering on anybody. Vitellius was having his last snack up in the palace on Palatine, was dragged down to the forum, tortured to death, and Vespasian took over. Now, Vespasian founds the next group of emperors, the so-called Flavian group, that ruled down to 96 A.D. Vespasian himself was a strong man, and he managed fairly quickly to bring order to the empire again. The siege against Jerusalem was continued by his son Titus, and the zealots in Jerusalem held out, literally inch by inch, working on the assumption that God would work a miracle to save them, but he did not, and in fact Jerusalem was taken, the temple was destroyed, most of Jerusalem was destroyed, and the Jews themselves were dispersed. Now this is the famous diaspora of the Jews when they were scattered throughout the Roman Empire, mainly, of course, in the eastern part of the empire at this time. And Jerusalem was to be left waste until the mid-second century, when a Roman city was founded there called Aelia Capitolina. And this is the beginning of the new Jerusalem. But this marks the dispersal of the Jewish peoples. And indeed, It marks the end of Judaism being a temple state and begins the importance now of the synagogues and of the rabbis as leaders of Judaism stems from this particular event in history. Aside from this, Vespasian managed to deal effectively with the empire. He is, as a whole, a good emperor. And he is succeeded by his son Titus, who reigns for only 2 years, and then the younger son Domitian takes over. Now Domitian becomes something of a tyrant and quarrels again with the Roman Senate. There are a number of conspiracies against him, and he becomes increasingly paranoid and indeed suspicious of everyone, with, I must say, some cause, because in 96 he's killed off. And at this point, the Senate indeed reasserts itself. There was a general belief, the so-called stoical concept at this time of government, that the person who should reign is the best man in the empire for rule, and that it should not, of necessity, go down by family descent. And the result is that the Senate now chooses the next ruler, and they choose an elderly man named Nerva. And Nerva is the beginning of the period of the so-called five good emperors. They reign from 96 to 180 A.D., and this is perhaps the most peaceful and in many ways the most brilliant period of Rome in terms of its economy, in terms of general population increase, in terms of welfare, law. All of these things flourish in this period. Though just before the end of it, problems will begin to rise again. Now, Nerva had no children. And so he did name as his successor a man who had been born in Spain, who was a general, named Trajan. And Trajan is, again, one of the great emperors of the whole Roman period. Trajan was a man who did a great deal to help out impoverished areas. He helped the poor farmers in Italy by grants of money at a much lower interest rate. Instead of 12%, he dropped it to 5%. And indeed, the money, when it was paid back, was left in the area of the farmers to aid poor people in that area. He set up special funds to take care of widows and orphans. He did an enormous amount to improve the general tone of the entire empire. And he was also a major general. Now, the empire reaches its greatest extent under Trajan. There had been trouble along the Danube frontier from Germanic tribes that were putting pressure on that area, and there had been a revolt north of the Danube, and Trajan now, indeed, put on a major war north of the Danube in the area that is today Romania. And he captured this section called Dacia, and created a new Roman province. Now this new province was very intensely Romanized by the moving of Roman citizens into it. And one of the results, lasting results of that, is that Romania is the only part of the Balkans which still speaks a Roman form of language and not Slavic tongue at all. So the Romanization of Dacia, which and the conquest of Dacia lasted down to 250 A.D., is a major event. Now, he also moved against the Parthians on the eastern frontier. There, he defeated the Parthians and went right straight down the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, captured their capital city there at Ctesiphon, and started to establish a new Roman province in Mesopotamia. Now, just as he was completing that, Trajan dies. And he is succeeded by, he has no children, he is succeeded by another Spaniard named Hadrian. And Hadrian, again, is one of the great emperors in Roman history. Hadrian had experience in war and also in administration. Hadrian is about 40 when he becomes emperor, and he immediately decides that Rome is overextended. And the result is that he abandons Mesopotamia to the Parthians, lets them take it back. Under Trajan, Armenia had been captured and turned into a province. Now Hadrian set it up again as a buffer state between Parthia and the East, or at least the Roman Empire, and set it up as a client kingdom again. He did retain Dacia. And then Hadrian set out on 10 years of journeying to all parts of the Roman Empire. He visited every single province, and indeed he was careful when he traveled to travel with a relatively small entourage so that it would not be a great expense to the cities that he visited. And he left indeed memorials of his travels everywhere, giving monies to cities to bring in aqueducts, establishing baths, various kinds of public buildings. He is a major benefactor from one part of the Roman Empire to the other. He also, of course, in Britain, builds Hadrian's Wall as a frontier to establish, again, a workable limit to empire. And with all of this, he then settles down in Rome and does a series of sweeping innovations. For one thing, he entirely remodels the Roman bureaucracy. And he established a kind of bureaucratic line of advancement. And he saw to it that the group of persons who were hired in the new bureaucracy were what we would call the middle class. It's the group of Romans called the equestrian class or the knights. And these are chosen to be represented in the new bureaucracy. At the head are, of course, still the Senate and the senatorial class. But he remodels that bureaucracy, and it is basically this Hadrianic remodeling of the bureaucracy which establishes it so well that the one thing that eventually holds the empire together through a long period of troubles is the Roman bureaucracy, which becomes an extraordinarily working, cohesive organization. In addition to this, Hadrian went over the entire legal system and brought order to this, establishing a new code of Roman law that carried his name. Hadrian, indeed, is an extraordinarily brilliant working emperor. Now, when Hadrian died, finally, he left the... He also had no children, and the rule was left to a man from Gaul. You will note that these emperors are coming from the provinces. Indeed, the Flavian dynasty were not a Roman family, but an Italian family. Now they're coming from the provinces that had been settled early on. And Antoninus Pius, who followed Hadrian, is a perfectly good emperor, but one who does no innovation. He's one who just lets things roll along the way Hadrian had established them, in other words. Hadrian's establishment is good enough so that you can have, in essence, a nice, moral, do-nothing emperor. Think of Antoninus Pius as maybe a little like Eisenhower. And operates roughly this way. Now, Hadrian had also established the line of succession after Antoninus Pius. Indeed, Hadrian is the person who sets everything up for the future. And this was, again, a young Spanish boy who was raised under Antoninus Pius. This is Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius is, of course, a philosopher king. He is a Stoic himself, who writes a famous set of essays. The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius are one of the great statements, indeed, of Stoic philosophy. And Marcus Aurelius is the emperor who inherits the new time of troubles. They begin relatively slowly with problems up along the German frontier, because the Germanic tribes are now again having a population burst and are beginning to press against the frontiers, particularly against the Danube frontier, and also real disaster occurs in this reign. He has a young co-emperor named Lucius Verus, who is sent with armies to the east to fight against the Parthians again. And when that army returned back to Italy, they brought with it a plague. Now, this is one of the great plagues of history, and we are not sure which this plague is. It seems to have been either smallpox or measles. Neither had ever appeared in the West before, and the result was, indeed, that the plague, being brought back by the army from the east, swept through the entire Roman Empire. And in a period of about 15 years of sweeping back and forth, it kills off somewhere between one-fourth and one-third of the entire population of the Western Empire. In other words, it is one of those great, enormous plagues in history. And this, of course, is the beginning now of the bad times for the Roman Empire. It is the first great blow. Indeed, parts of the empire are simply left depopulated in the West, where there are lands that are simply abandoned, that had been farmed before. The population drops extraordinarily. And while this is going on, Marcus Aurelius, with his armies, is operating up on the other side of the Danube against the Germanic tribes. Now, he had already overwhelmed and received the submission of several tribes, and he was operating from a base located approximately where Vienna is today, that is, up on the Danube in that area, when he too caught the plague. And he is one of the last victims of this great plague of the 2nd century A.D. He dies in 180. And it also marks the end of the great days of the Roman Empire. Unlike all of the other emperors that had preceded in this group, Marcus Aurelius has a son. And he breaks the chain of picking the best man to be emperor, and instead his son Commodus is established as emperor. Now, Commodus was a young man, and he simply abandoned the entire German campaign, and the result is that the German problem is never resolved by the Roman Empire. This was one of the fateful things that happened. He retired back to Rome, where he was very happily involved in the flesh pots of the capital city for quite a long time. He is one of the bad emperors, which I suppose proves that adopted followers are better than natural children. And he is primarily interested in gladiators and in himself being a gladiator. He assumed that he was a reincarnation of Hercules, he liked to think, and he was a remarkably silly man in most respects. As you might expect, he is eventually slaughtered off by the Praetorian Guard. And what happens next is one of the real low points of Roman history. In a kind of strange way, the Praetorian Guard, which was the only army group located in the city of Rome, literally auctioned off the empire in an extraordinary, unbelievable auction in which they approached the two wealthiest men in Rome, who barricaded themselves in their houses, and offered the empire to them. And the men started bidding against each other. So much cash to the head of the Praetorian Guard, so much to each member of the Praetorian Guard. Then the Praetorian Guard would go to the other house, get a higher offer, and so you have an active auction going on. Now, eventually, of course, they did decide this, but the concept that the emperorship of Rome should be auctioned off by the Praetorian Guard, needless to say, deeply offended the armies of Rome. So once more, the armies swing into action. Now, you will note through all this that a constant problem in Rome is the succession to emperorship. That in the Julio-Claudians, you tried out succession within the family. Then you have the generals and the armies taking over. You again have succession by family. Then you have the Senate establishing the concept of adoption of the best man. Now you have the army swinging back again. This is the one level in which Rome has a very hard time establishing working precedence. Now, when the generals swept back, there is again civil war. And this time, the victor out of the entire group comes from the province of Africa, and his name is Septimius Severus. Now, he's a major general, and as a general, he starts what is sometimes called the military dictatorship of the empire, because he rules very specifically by maintaining control of the armies. So you now have the concept of military dictatorship, and it is right through this period that the Roman economy begins to fail in some respects. That enormous population loss and loss of wealth had begun to damage the economy. The result was that they weren't collecting enough taxes to pay both the armies and the bureaucracy that ran the state. So they began debasing the currency. In other words, they took a certain amount of silver out of the quarters and so on. The nickels were no longer made of nickel. Gold pieces were washed with gold rather than being true gold. This debasement of the currency is going on for a long time. But of course, it means that the value of the currency falls and you have an inflation spiral set in, which is highly damaging, particularly to the middle class. Septimius Severus maintains the empire. He is married to a woman, Julia Domna, who came from Syria. And this is to be important in the long run. He has two sons named Geta and Caracalla, who are a genuinely horrid pair of boys. He takes the whole family with him on his wars in Britain, where he tries to conquer up into Scotland. And indeed, on one occasion there, he turns around just in time to find his boy Caracalla aiming a spear at him. And he takes this very poorly. He takes Caracalla to the tent and says, "Now that's no way to do things. If you want to kill me, do it to my face and now." And Caracalla is deeply ashamed and says, "Oh, forget it." Nonetheless, not long after this, Septimius Severus does die, and the rule is left jointly to his two sons, Geta and Caracalla. Now, they all go back to Rome, and the two boys hate each other with a deadly loathing. They consider dividing the empire, one taking the east and one the west. But they both stay in Rome, under heavy guard, rarely daring to go out or to see each other. And finally, Caracalla manages to get his brother to meet him in the apartments of their mother. Now, Geta goes along with this. Caracalla has soldiers stationed. And in fact, Geta is killed in the arms of his mother, dropping dead at her feet. And Caracalla then forbids her to weep over her son's death under the pain of being killed herself. Not really one of the nicer persons. However, very popular with the army. And his rule indeed continues, in which he's rather monstrous, in fact. He slaughters a lot of people. Anyone whom he suspects might be a danger to him, he simply kills off. So there's a lot of sort of random massacring around. This finally climaxes on the day when his mistress, Marcia, discovers that she's on the new list to be slaughtered off. And she takes a very dim view of that and points out to the head of the Praetorian Guard, the new guard, that he's going to be on the list shortly also. So they kill Caracalla. Now, Caracalla did not leave any children. On the other hand, he was still very popular with the armies. And the result was that he had some cousins in Syria, two women also named Julia. And one of them was bright enough to insist that her son, Elagabalus, had actually been sired by Caracalla and was really his son. Now, this is probably not true, but the army was willing to buy it. And the result was that Elagabalus is proclaimed as emperor. Now, a worse choice could hardly have been made. Elagabalus is notoriously about the lowest point the empire will ever reach. This is a boy who is 14 years old, who has been devoted to the worship of Elagabal, a fertility god in Syria. And, of course, fertility rites in Syria are somewhat elaborate and madly sexual. And he was devoted to the worship of this particular god. Now, when he moved to Rome at 14, he brought the worship of Elagabalus, or Elagabal, with him to Rome. Now, the Romans may have been dissipated, but they hadn't seen anything like this ever. Temple prostitution, castrated priests, all the rest of this paraphernalia, with the young emperor indeed posing as the high priest of this affair, and indeed spending all too much of his time looking for people who could perform religious rites properly with him. Now, notably, for instance, on one occasion there are chariot races up in the palace area. And right in front of the imperial box, one of the chariots is upset, and the young charioteer is overthrown, and his clothes are in great disarray. And Elagabalus notices to his delight that this young man is perhaps better equipped for religious exercise than anyone he has ever seen. And the result is that he is whisked into the palace as a high favorite. The scandals of this reign are beyond belief. Elagabalus is supposed to have set himself up in a small room with a beaded curtain that senators had to pass, and he would lounge in the doorway beckoning them in and charging them a high price for his services, all of this in the name of religion. It was indeed, after a few years, really more than anybody in Rome could stomach. And the armies were a good deal less fond of him by that time. The result was that he is slaughtered off ruthlessly in Rome, and his body is thrown into an open sewer. Well, like to like, at long last. He is followed by his cousin, whose mother, another one of the Julias, also proclaimed that he had been sired by Caracalla. One more time they tried this. And that young man, Alexander Severus, is not at all like his cousin. He goes up indeed to the Rhine armies, but there is killed off. Now that's in 235 A.D. And the next period, the period from 235 to 285, is a dread and terrible period for the Roman Empire. It's a period in which, in the period of 50 years, there are 36 Roman emperors. I'm not going to list all of them for you. You'll be happy to know. In other words, what you have is a period of almost constant civil war going on between the various armies. And these civil wars ravage province after province, and they are a continuing factor. Indeed, at one time, one part of the Western Empire, Gaul, and for a while Britain, split off from the rest of the empire and tried to proclaim their own independence. So you sometimes have as many as two or three emperors working at the same time in various parts of the empire. And the emperors themselves are an extraordinarily mixed lot. Almost all of them stem from the army, but not all of them, at one crucial period there. It is the Senate which reasserts itself and simply says, enough is enough, and selects a new emperor themselves. That emperor doesn't last either. His son doesn't last. None of them last. But they are exotic. They mainly come from out-of-the-way parts of the empire. Indeed, at one time, there is a leader of an Arabian tribe. Philip the Arab becomes one of the emperors. Perhaps the most extraordinary is a man from Thrace, Maximinus Thrax, who seems to have stood something like 8 feet tall. He was beloved by the army, but he was a thoroughly boorish type with his own peculiar kicks. One of them seems to have been, if we may trust the sources, and I add hastily, we may not. But his particular kick seemed to have been scraping off his own perspiration and drinking it. He also is killed off. You have a family from Africa come in, the Guardians, a whole long series of these emperors. At times, indeed, some of them make some headway and establish a little order. But as a whole, it is an enormous period of decline. Worse than this, it is a period which begins a very important economic decline in the Roman Empire, because this is, of course, enormously expensive. And all of these armies require taxes, and every time you have a new emperor, by tradition, all cities or municipia pay a special tax, a donation, to the new emperor. Well, now, this was one thing when an emperor ruled for 15 to 20 years. It's another one when you've got three in the same year. This is the kind of taxation which is devolved. Beyond this, indeed, the armies in civil war meant that the frontiers frequently were not being well guarded, and it becomes a practice to invite barbarian groups in across the frontier to settle down on lands given them along the frontier. Now, many of these lands had become depopulated due to the plague and civil war, but they are settled there, in fact, to guard the frontier against other barbarian tribes. What I want you to note is the fact that the first entry of barbarians is by invitation, not by invasion at all. The other thing I want you to note is that in this period, you find a shift in which Rome is looking for its leaders further and further away from the old heartland. You have this as a constant repeating series of events. The Julio-Claudians are old Roman families. The Flavians are Italian families. Next come the Spaniards, the Gauls, the Africans, the Syrians, Philip the Arab, Thracians, and so on. In other words, the center is always having to be strengthened by bringing in people now from the province. Again and again, people are brought into the senatorial class from Rome, from Gaul, from Spain, from Africa, and the senatorial class, tending to die out, is replenished from the province. And so that what is happening here is that the old heartland is consistently weakening out and is having to be aided and replenished from the more recent conquest, the frontier areas. This, indeed, in a period of Rome's weakening, looks indeed as though, if you're going to say that Rome decays or begins to die now, it dies at the center first, not on the fringes. And indeed, you can make some argument for this particular approach. The surprising thing is that by 285, it certainly did look as though the Roman Empire was finally tottering away to its final fall. Not at all. What happens is, I suppose, something of a miracle. You have a new emperor proclaimed, a man called Diocletian, in 285. Now, Diocletian comes from Illyria. That's the area that is today Yugoslavia, a mountainous and a backward Arab. He was a general, but he is again one of the extremely great administrative talents that Rome throws up periodically. Augustus, Hadrian, Diocletian are perhaps the great administrators of the Roman Empire. Diocletian comes in, of course, at a time when the entire empire is sick and tired of civil war, when they want a return to peace and a chance for prosperity above anything else. So the armies are willing to accept him, the senatorial class is willing to accept him, the bureaucracy has managed to keep things running, if just barely. So Diocletian comes in with an extraordinary set of reforms. He tries to reform the currency, and he does indeed bring out new coinage, which is good coinage again. Secondly, he tries to stop galloping inflation by establishing price controls. I might add the price controls don't work, but at least it does in part help to cut this galloping inflation within the Roman Empire. And he reorganizes the entire empire. He, instead of holding to the old provinces, he now divides it up into various divisions. A division between the east and the west, and then within this, into things called dioceses, which replace the old provinces. Now, there is too much problem on the frontiers for Diocletian to feel that he can manage as the single emperor. So he chooses a man to be co-emperor. Though Diocletian is always emperor number one, Maximian is emperor number two. Diocletian takes the Eastern Empire, and his co-emperor takes the West. Then Diocletian sees to it that each of them chooses a successor. Now, the two emperors are called the Augusti, after Augustus, and they choose two Caesars. Now, notably, this is again an attempt to choose the best persons to rule. In other words, we've moved back toward this concept here. And it's notable that they do not choose anyone related to them. They choose generals. And now, in the division of the empire, the young men, the Caesars, are given the frontier provinces and charge of the working armies there. And it is their duty to maintain the peace along the frontiers, while the leading emperors themselves rule the more settled and stable part and attempt to bring prosperity, all of these factors, back into the empire. And indeed, to a major degree, this new division succeeds. It seems literally to be working out extraordinarily well. And for the first time in a very long time, no emperors get slaughtered in this period. Indeed, in 305, Diocletian will announce that he is going to abdicate. Now, this is something no one had ever tried before, in fact. They just got slaughtered off. But he had built himself a rather splendid big palace on the Dalmatian coast, to which he wanted to retire. The palace is, in fact, still in existence. The whole town of Split in the Middle Ages was built inside its walls. It is still surprisingly intact there. And he insists, indeed, that his co-emperor also retire. Now, Maximian was not nearly as willing to retire as was Diocletian. Nonetheless, he's forced into it because Diocletian is that strong a personality. And Diocletian abdicates office, retires to his big palace, which has some nice big courtyards, and in one of them, he himself set about the rather pleasant business of growing cabbages. He could be found out hoeing and raking and picking off insects and happy with his cabbage patch. And indeed, Diocletian abdicates his power. When troubles come up again, he will be asked to take back the emperorship. And he will say, not on your life, you know.
I like raising cabbages. I don't get hung up with all that stuff anymore at all. He absolutely refuses to take it back, and he will die peaceably in his own bed. But he has also furthered something that started growing up in the bad period, the period of the civil wars and the many emperors. And this is to try to establish the emperor now as someone almost semi-divine and established remotely from the people themselves. They begin the process of court etiquette, whereby when you approach the emperor, you kneel down before him and press your head to the floor, your forehead to the floor. It's called proskynesis. All of this had been started before Diocletian, but it is now formalized by him. The attempt, of course, is quite literally to set the emperor apart so he doesn't get massacred all the time and to establish him in a kind of sacrosanct position. What's more, of course, it is rather hard to launch an attack when you're on your knees with your forehead to the floor. It's not the best position from which to charge. And so you have the concept of the deified emperor being extended now to a kind of living god, which had been part of the Eastern tradition anyway. It had been part of the pharaohs, it had occurred through the Near East, all of these things. So it is not new to them, but it is a major move away. Now, the same kind of problem that had deviled the empire before came up again now, and this was, of course, the fact that Maximian had named his successor, who had become Augustus, and had named a new successor Caesar, but Maximian had a natural son who wanted to inherit from his father, and the result is that you have a new period of civil wars break out. While there are Caesars and Augustuses, there are also natural sons who get into the new set of civil wars. Now, one of the sons who plays here is Constantine. Constantine was the son of Maximian's first Caesar, a man named Constantius, and it is notable that Constantine is born in Britain and that his mother, in fact, Helena, was a British woman. So that they're coming from further and further away and from more and more recent conquests. Now, there's a new long period of civil wars. The civil wars go on for a number of years and with a series of changing figures, and I don't want to get into all the problems of Galerius and all the rest of these people. I don't think you need remember those. Simply the point that the civil war is finally going to be finished with the victory of Constantine. And he will become Constantine the Great. Now, we're going to come back to him in further lectures. Let me simply say that what Constantine does is to move the capital away from Rome. Rome had lost its position as capital city more or less before this, but now a new capital city is founded on the site of an old Greek town called Byzantium. And it will be renamed Constantinople, the polis of Constantine. And he will lay out a new city which will be the new capital for the entire Roman Empire. So Rome now becomes simply a favored city within the empire. It is favored in that Rome is still given free bread and is free from a certain amount of taxation, these factors. But it has now lost its central position. Constantine considered, in fact, several locations before deciding on Constantinople. He's afraid primarily of the Danube frontier and the eastern frontier. So what he is trying to do is to move the capital to a more viable position near the main sources of trouble. Equally, the capital in the west will be moved away from Rome though it's not the main capital, up to Milan, which again is closer to the German tribal area, so that again you're moving away from the old center. Now Constantine is of course famous in various other ways, and Constantine and the question of Christianity is something we will face up to in another lecture. I have skated through several hundred emperors in this one. That's enough.